Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Normally, Alex joins us on Monday, but because I'm traveling, he's joining us on Tuesday. So, joining us from Georgia. What part of Georgia do you live in?
I live in a town called Cumming, about 30, 45 minutes north of Atlanta. If you could fly at a driving speed, if you actually want to take 400 into Atlanta, it's a nice brisk 3 hours or so. Traffic in Atlanta is awful. Even amid the coronavirus, you would think that you'd think the roads would clear up a little bit, but Atlanta was just really poorly designed. But before I keep complaining, I wanted to wish you a happy Father's Day, man. Belated a few days, but you were one of the first dads to give me fatherly advice a couple of years ago now. When, you know, for anybody who doesn't know this, when I was in the hospital with my wife giving birth to my daughter almost 3 years ago now, which is crazy. Mac was the guy reaching out to me to give me some advice that day and to help keep my head on my shoulders. World's greatest birthing coach, especially for the dads that don't have to do anything. But happy Father's Day, man.
Self-proclaimed world's greatest birthing coach. I am, and I'm if you're in the region, Southern California, or if you want to fly me there, I will gladly support the birth of your child. So for anybody out there that needs help, I'm there. No, thank you very much. We celebrated Father's Day last week as my daughters were out of town. My sons are in different parts of the country, so my daughters came over and they brought dinner, and I cooked it, and then we sat outside. we sat outside and had dinner. No, but it was wonderful. I'm a big deal. You know, all you have to do to make me happy is to make me a card. Right.
I'm totally the same way. I don't need on birthdays. I'm not a big gift guy. Like, just saying, hey, happy birthday, happy Father's Day, giving me a pat on the shoulder means a lot. You know, I'm not too worried about whether or not you bought me something expensive.
Got it. I told that to my daughter and she looked at me. And she said, what? I said, yeah, you don't. You don't need to buy me anything anymore. She said, Dad, what are you talking about? And I said, look, this whole thing of, you know, get me something. I don't need that anymore in my life. Okay. I don't. She said, what do you want? I said, just, you know, what do I always tell you I want? Make a card. And I said, that's all. So my kids, they make these stupid cards, right? They get a picture of us, and then they make something. And so,
and what's even cooler about that is that now that your kids are older, it's probably one of the few experiences like that that they have in their lives right now. You know, like making a card for Dad, or you know, I can't tell you how irregular it is for me to like make something with my hands other than in the workshop, you know, playing with tools and whatnot. But I never draw a picture. I never write something by hand. It gives it a lot of meaning. I love that.
Well, and you know, and they say funny stuff too, right? But it's interesting. They always include something that's happened relative to you recently. So they'll say, Dad, you know, you're the greatest dad ever, right? And all the boilerplate shit that people put in those cards. But then they'll say something that's important to them. And that is essentially the beauty of these cards. So, and I keep them, you know. I still have cards they made for me when they were little because they made them for me. And so, So they were at first like, is this some kind of ruse or something? No. I don't want.
It's a trick.
I've told that once. It's a trick. It's always a trick.
I mean, my wife and I fell into that trap for many years where we would both say, oh, no, I don't want anything. Don't worry about it. For Christmas, for birthdays. And then we would both buy each other something anyway, but we would be so far off on what we felt was an appropriate price range that every year one of us felt like an asshole.
Yeah.
Like, right. We've narrowed it down a lot now. Now, you know, my wife and I have been together for it'll be 15 years pretty soon.
Wow.
And what we do now is we just identify a budget and we tell the other person, like, for instance, for Father's Day, my wife was like, well, what would you like for Father's Day? And I was like, honestly, nothing. I buy myself all kinds of dumb stuff all the time. And I don't do anything but work.
What
so
can,
I don't
what
have
can
a
you buy
of
me that
life.
I haven't bought myself yet?
But there's this one really cool handguard for my rifle I've wanted for a little while, but I felt like was a waste of money. So she was like, I tell you what, as long as you spend under $150 on whatever gun parts you want, I'm not going to give you a hard time. So that was my Father's Day gift. I went and bought a new set of handrails for my AR. Came in under budget, so she's not allowed to give me a hard time. And as far as that's way cooler than, like, you know, the tie she would have given me that I would have hung up in my closet because I never dress up. So I like our approach.
Yeah, no kidding. No, that's good because, I mean, there's always that whole butthurt, you know, thing that you didn't put any thought into it and all of that. So, and to me, a gift is something you wouldn't really buy yourself. But most of
the
time –
that's the whole nature of gifts, right? For me too. I agree.
Most of the time, the reason I won't buy it for myself, it's too expensive. So I'm not going to ask you – right to do it.
Absolutely. You know, because again, $90 for a handguard seems pretty stupid. So I wouldn't do it unless I had a good excuse, I guess. But I agree completely. And honestly, to your point about the handmade cards, I'm not a big fan of the platitude gifts. You know what I mean? Like here's a thing that we just figured dads would want, or here's a thing that's loosely related to something you're interested in that I saw. I would much rather something written down that talks about us, our relationship right. to one another. I love that idea. I really do.
You know, I still have, looking around, my number two son, and it's like partly ripped. It's on my wall. Let me grab it. And it's something he made in school. And it says, and there's an Atlanta Braves little plastic baseball helmet on it. I'm not sure why the Braves are on it because neither one of us are Braves fans. It's probably just little and it worked. There's a picture of he and I laminated on the on this piece of wood that he used. And we're sitting on his bike. He's probably, in this picture, he might be 6 or 7, right? He's sitting on my lap, and we're sitting on his bike. And it says, my father. My dad is very special. I love him very much. He tickles and hugs me. He likes to make me laugh. Sometimes when we are tired, we just sit side by side, and then there's a rip. And it says, I love you. Happy Father's Day. You know, June, whatever, which is ripped, Patrick. And now this is made, I don't know how many years ago, 24 years ago. And it still hangs, you know, on the wall of my office. And so
that's the coolest thing
right?
ever.
And they're flawed, right? There's fucked up stuff about it, but it's, you know, it's somebody that took, right, a little bit of time out of their day to tell you something. And so I've been always a huge fan of those. And my kids think I'm screwing with them. Like, really? We're going to do this? I'm like, no, look, I mean, you know, so what do I want? Like, do you want to, you know, you want to take me out to dinner for Father's Day? I'd love to do that. And the same thing with Christmas. You know, I don't need a gift from you, right? If you want to buy tickets to a play, let's go to a play. Let's make a memory together. So I'm, you know, I don't know if that means I'm really old, but I would
maybe it just means that you're a dad. You know, because like I
no, it means I'm really. I think it means I'm really cool. Right?
Yeah, it must mean that we're awesome. Is what I think we're really getting at here. But no, I'm very much the same way, and more so in recent years, especially I think to your point since I became a dad. I like yesterday. I did not want to go out to dinner. I'm not a big fan of crowded spaces and stuff like that. So we just did one of those, you know, diner dash or whatever, had them deliver, you know, a steak to the house so that my wife didn't have to cook. And But what I had the most fun doing yesterday is – so my wife and I text each other pictures and videos of my daughter pretty much every day. Like just, it's as much a, hey, you weren't in the room for this. Check this out as anything. But we just went back. I went back like the last year and a half of the videos that I have got saved on my phone of my daughter. And we just flipped through them one by one and just watched my daughter grow up over the last year and a half, which – you know, my daughter is 2.5 now, so the last year and a half has been really rapid growth. She's changed dramatically. But that's the thing that meant the world to me. You know, that was the best part of Father's Day for me, was sitting there with my wife and my kid and looking at what a little kid my kid was just a year ago and having her not believe that they were pictures and videos of her. That's the part of this Father's Day I'm going to remember. If you bought me something expensive, I probably would remember that something very nice fondly right up until I lost it.
Right, or broke it and then threw it away.
Or broke it, yeah.
No, I'm with you. And that's why these things, I mean, to me, like I've always been fan. I would tell you this. I think being a dad is one of the coolest parts of life. And I've said this before, but I was under the impression when I was younger that for some reason that your kids stop needing you at about the age of 22 or 23 when they graduated from college. And that's not true. Your kids never stop needing somebody to talk to, somebody they can frame an issue with, you know, something they can bounce shit, somebody they can bounce ideas off because you've gone down that road before. And you know, sometimes it's relationship stuff. Sometimes it's you know, it's whatever, but I think it's easily one of the most enjoyable parts of life for all of us. And it's being a dad has been the one thing in my life that I value right up there at the top of all the other things that I am on this planet. Being a dad to four kids, each one of them so different, right? And is awesome. So
That's the thing, man. I really think being a parent is maybe this is true for you. It's certainly been true for me over the years. I've had a lot of goals and objectives, you know what I mean? And I've been fortunate enough to lead a life where I've managed to meet a lot of my goals, but they're never quite what you imagine they'd be. You know, I pursued my undergraduate degree like, you know, for 15 years or something, right? I've dropped out of far more colleges than I've ever graduated from. And so when I finally did, prior to getting my bachelor's degree, I thought that like the world was different for people with bachelor's degrees until I got mine and realized that everything is literally exactly the same, but I have a very expensive piece of paper hanging on my wall.
Right.
The same thing with joining the Marine Corps. You imagine getting through recruit training. Once I'm through recruit training, everything's going to be different. The whole world will be better. You get through recruit training, you realize they still have no idea what you're doing or where you are or what you're supposed to be. You know, getting out of the Marine Corps is another one of those things where you think about it for a long, long time and you anticipate it to be something that really changes the fabric of you. And then it happens and you're surprised to find that you feel like the same guy. You know, now I'm hairier, now I'm a little fatter. But I am very much the same guy that Sergeant Hollings was. But my daughter being born is the only time that I had something built up in my mind as like this bigger than life-changing kind of thing, and actually was. You know, my perspective on the world actually did change. So it's really the only thing in my whole life that has lived up to its own expectations, you know?
You know, when you're married, right, and you're a Marine, and, you know, I was an infantryman, and, you know, you think, well, you know, we do dangerous stuff. If something bad happens, you know, she's going to get about $500,000. You know, she's a young, attractive woman. She'll be okay. That all changed for me as soon as we had a kid.
Mm-hmm.
It's like
100%.
I don't feel the same way getting in these helicopters, right? Going on these small boats, you know, fast roping, spy rigging, you know, all the things that you do in the normal course of your career, you know, there's always, now I have a little voice, you know, because I don't want anybody else to raise him. I don't want anybody else to walk her down the aisle when she gets married, you know, and so you have a stake in it now, it seems like. So I agree with you. It's interesting, like all the things that happen in your life, you know, you seem to absorb. Fatherhood changes things to me.
I got like, I agree with you so much that I actually wrote an op-ed a few years ago about the biggest thing that changed for me becoming a dad was, as I put it, renegotiating my relationship with death. I really do think before my daughter was born, and unlike you, I was fortunate enough that my daughter was born after I had already gotten out of service, so I didn't really need to face those fears the same way that you did. But I really I think I always sort of intended to die young, not like in a suicidal sense, but I think I always just anticipated that the type of guy I was would probably go out with a bang early in my life,
and I'd
be the kind of guy maybe you'd tell stories about, you know?
James Dean-esque.
Yeah, and then instead my daughter was born, and I immediately went from I intend to die young to now I hope to live forever. I'm like, all of a sudden I'm worrying about what I eat. I'm going to actually go to the doctor when things go wrong. Like
things I've never done in my life.
Exactly. My friends and I, you know, my best buddy, German, he was in the Marine Corps with me. He now works at GE. He's a dad too. But we would always, before we had kids, our idea of a good time was very much informed by the threat level involved.
Right.
We're going to try to climb this mountain because it's a dumb idea.
Right.
We're going to try to do this because it's a dumb idea. I went and wrestled alligators just because it was a dumb idea. Right. And then my daughter was born and I was like, well,
maybe not.
Shit. Yeah. Maybe I'm going to stop. Maybe I need to shift my idea of fun away from the likelihood that I'll die, and now instead I build Legos in my basement.
Exactly. You're that. No, but again, there's no and I think everybody that's a parent, mothers probably more so than fathers, but you know, we're part of the event too. I was telling my kids yesterday, because my daughter, she was saying, I feel bad that nobody's there on Father's Day. I said, Catherine, I don't even know what day Father's Day is, okay? Except when I read about it, right? If you ask me, like, when's Father's Day? I was like, I don't know. In June, right?
Yeah.
And I said, look, we all know that Father's Day is a redheaded stepchild of Mother's Day, okay? Mother's Day is the event, okay? Father's Day is just there because, well, shit, we had one. We got to have the other, right? Right? But look, school's out, so kids don't, you know, like, Mother's Day's a big school project, right? Summer vacation, man. What?
Yeah, right.
Make it, do what? Oh, Dad, no, fuck that.
Right? Get him a tie.
Can we buy him? Yeah, a tie. I said, so it's really, look, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. And so, no, but again, I mean, it's to me, watching your kids grow up, seeing them, you know, conquer all the little demons from the time they're little, from riding a bike, right? And that terrifying event when you let go of the seat and they don't have any training wheels on. And then you see this front steering wheel, like, start to wobble. And you're like, oh, shit, wobble. Here it comes. And then,
I'm not there yet. We're still on the tricycle with the handle on the back.
Then you
so
see,
I still have full control.
Well, blam! And then, you know, then they hit the deck and they're screaming. And, you know, you run up there and you're like, what are you crying for? I don't know. Well, stop crying, man. Get on the bike. Let's go. We're going to do this thing. And you know, you're teaching them how to be tough guys. And I believe, you know, toughness is a quality that helps you in life. And
I
so,
agree.
Right, they're wiping the tears from their eyes. Your wife's staring at you like, you ass. And then you're like, come on, get on. We're going to do this. You can do this. And then they do it, and the joy on their face, right? All of a sudden, they're riding their bike, the mud puppy. Right. So anyway, it's doing that over and over and over as they conquer issue after issue in life. And then you see them become, you know, get married, be parents. I said this to my older son yesterday. There's no greater joy in my life than watching my oldest son be a father. My daughters are like, oh, Dad, my grandson's name is Finn, right? Isn't Finn so cute? And I'm like, yeah, he's cute. I mean, I love kids, right? You know, but I've had four of those, okay? I've seen this before. What I've never seen is Mr. Potato Head, the professor, as I used to call him, who was mesmerized by Doc Emmett Brown in Back to the Future, right?
Who wasn't?
Right?
I love Back to the Future.
Be a father. He's a father. He wouldn't bring his bike in out of the rain, and he's a father now. But he's a good father. He's a great father. And he loves being a father. And I said, that, when we're all together, I watch that. That's what I've never seen in my life, and I love watching that.
That's awesome. Yeah. To your point, also to that point about you always needing your parents, this was my second Father's Day since my dad passed away, which is something I tend not to engage with all that much, right. You know, just for whatever personal reasons. But my mom sent me a message and said, hey, you know, your dad would be really proud of the father that you are. Just that.
Whoa.
The world to me. I went from, hey, I'm a big tough guy, to a blubbering pile of crap. You know, I've got my daughter on my lap trying not to let her see dad cry.
Oh, you know? Shit. And your mom just rocked your shit.
Dropped a bomb on me. Dropped a bomb. And you know, when my phone went off, I am definitely that guy who gets like the anxiety pang if my phone goes off on a Sunday afternoon, because 99% of my correspondence is work-related.
Right.
And we did just launch an entirely new revamped site, so I was expecting fully to get a message this weekend saying everything was on fire. And then, so I looked at my phone, like, in terror, and got that message from my mom instead, and then blubbered like a baby for like 45 minutes. You know that thing you do? I don't cry very often. I'm not a big crier. So your eyes just kind of get red and right. You just act like you're tired.
Allergies. Allergies.
Yeah.
Come on.
Something's up with my eyes. It's the weirdest thing. Yeah, I'm just going to.
Pollen. Pollen kicking my ass.
Yeah. But man, I'm glad you had a good Father's Day.
Let me tell you, though, that's
my favorite thing to do.
Your mom. Yikes, just
right?
Coming Man. Off the top rope into the inner sanctum too. It's not right? like she landed in the balcony or in the foyer.
And it wasn't like we were already talking about stuff and she knew that I was in a good emotional place to talk about my dad. No, just out of the blue. But honestly, really meaningful. But kind of like what you're saying, though,
right.
I doubt there's many things that matter more to your son than the fact that you're proud of the dad he is. I can tell you firsthand experience how meaningful that is.
Yeah. No. And again, it's the coolest. Okay. Look, we've talked about a lot of sentimental stuff.
We got pretty mushy here.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of weird. The whole world is on fire these days. Give me a general thought on all of it. I mean, you're younger than I am. You're in a digital media business. This is something I don't know the nation has ever seen, which would be some movement in the country. Animated and energized by horrific video, and then hyper something, hyper inflated, hyper by this digital world that we're all connected by. I don't know that the nation's ever seen this. You're watching things happen. So give me a couple thoughts about this.
I agree completely. And I guess when it comes to the political side of this, I think one thing that would benefit us all to recognize a bit more, this is the one good thing I'd ask that people do. I fully understand that people have strong feelings, opinions, and beliefs that are being questioned in one way or another as of late, either being questioned or maybe just we're putting into question. But I do think that we all need to start disowning our own assholes a little bit more. You know, like I see it in the Black Lives Matter camp. You know, there's been a lot of tweets over the weekend about, yes, we understand that a lot of the Black Lives Matter stuff is anti-Semitic, but let's not engage with that anti-Semitism right now because we're focused specifically on Black issues. And I see it, you know, on the other side too, where it's like, of course we're all reasonable and of course we all like this, but then you do see people on that other side that are crazy and saying awful things. I think we need to do a better job of disowning the awful elements of our own groups. We're all really eager to point to and shine a light on the worst elements of the other, whichever the other may be for you, right? But let's try to remember that there's a whole bunch of assholes on both sides of this debate. But for me personally, I've had a lot of trouble, I suppose – processing all of this. And I think in large part because I have spent my entire professional adult life focusing so much on foreign policy that I think it's fair to say domestic politics are a pretty big blind spot, a bigger blind spot than I was aware of, you know? And because I find myself having to Google stuff all the time. Like, I don't understand why there's such an emphasis on there needing to be a shift in the way law enforcement is practiced when there's no discussion whatsoever on a shift in the way that prosecution handles things. There doesn't seem to be any discussion whatsoever in terms of authority or those that we need – those places we need to enact change. It seems to start and finish at that patrol officer level, which I think is super short-sighted. If we're worried, if we're upset that police officers are committing violent crimes and they're not being prosecuted, the police officers aren't the only place we should be looking at. We should be looking at prosecution in this country. Why do most prosecutors defer police investigations to a grand jury? It's because they have to work with police officers and they're afraid of hurting that relationship. That right there is something that we really can address. We really can try to work on and see if we can find a solution for. But instead, both sides of the argument are really more worried about which statues we need to tear down, which in my opinion, I understand people are upset about statues. I understand other people are upset about the destruction of history. Personally, for me, I have a lot of trouble getting riled up about a statue one way or the other. I'm much more interested in addressing maybe the process or the system in which that we make sure police officers are held accountable for their actions. That seems like a very easy thing we can address that we're ignoring. But aside from my horrible blind spot with domestic politics, I'll tell you from my professional perspective – we are creating a vast opportunity for foreign influence in this turmoil. And I know that that's not the most important issue for most Americans right now. I understand that a lot of Americans right now are trying to shine a light on concerns they have domestically that do matter. But we need to not take our eye off the security ball. And I think a lot of us are. That's not the worst thing in the world. The public can focus on one thing while the defense apparatus focuses on another. But the defense apparatus is placing a great deal of its focus on these domestic issues too. Rightfully so, of course. But we need to not take our eye off the ball. The National Interest published a revisionist history op-ed by Vladimir Putin last week. China has recently announced effectively that they have claimed victory in the South China Sea because the United States was not able to mount a sizable naval presence in the Pacific in recent months. You know, we have growing concerns about withdrawing troops from Germany and whether or not we really would be able to defend something like the Suwalki Gap from a Russian offensive. We've got looming concerns about the South China Sea, about the oil trade, about OPEC, about Syria, about Libya, about Venezuela. And I really do agree that we need to be focused on improving as a nation right now. But I'm worried that we're so focused on improving as a nation that when Vladimir Putin issued a statement last week in support of Black Lives Matter, talking about the failings of the United States government, we're eager to accept that because we're like, look, even Putin says we should fix something instead of recognizing it for what it is, which is smoke and mirrors. It's another means by which to degrade the discourse within the United States. So I definitely understand that there are important issues domestically. I definitely understand they deserve our focus and our attention. But I am worried that we're not paying attention to some of the other wolves at the door because we're so focused on either these protests and riots, which are of course important, or the coronavirus, which is of course important. But the thing is that these protests are eventually going to die down. We have to hope there will be some actual change that comes for the better that may or may not happen depending on how any of this shakes out. We all know the coronavirus will eventually die down. We hope things change for the better, whether there's a vaccine or improved courses of treatment, or we just realize it's not that big of a deal. It's going to die down. When those threats to our discourse subside, The scary looming ones on the horizon will have not gone anywhere. If anything, they're only getting bigger. And that part's really scary to me.
Well, I'm a bit surprised that you're more concerned with foreign issues than domestic issues.
I think that really might not be a matter of the merit of domestic issues versus foreign ones. I think it really just might be – there's an old story that I don't know if it's true, but I really like the axiom where there was a city council that were gathering to discuss two pieces of legislation. One was whether or not they were going to fund this huge overhaul of their nuclear power apparatus within their community. The other one was about whether or not they were going to put a bike rack in front of the town or the city hall. When it came time to discuss and vote on the overhaul for the nuclear power apparatus, there was very little discussion. It went by with a majority favor. Everything was fine. When it got to discussing the bike rack, they debated it for 4 hours. And you could argue, is that because the bike rack was more important? No, I think it's because everyone felt ill-equipped to debate nuclear power, but everyone feels as though they can debate bike racks. And maybe that's what I'm doing right now. Maybe foreign policy is my bike rack, so I'm familiar with it. But I can't help but worry when foreign leaders that we know to be diplomatic, economic, even military opponents to the United States, when they start issuing statements in support of protests within the United States, we really need to understand that it's not because they're supporting a cause. You know, it's because they're supporting their own causes. It's because they're working in their own best interest. And if we don't think that China, Russia, Iran, even North Korea to some extent, aren't leveraging our turmoil right now, I mean, Russia does it, has been doing it for a long time, right? They don't invent issues for us to fight about. They exacerbate the ones that we are fighting about. Russia's still doing it. China is doing it more than ever. Iran is very active in it. Even Turkey, to some extent, is very active in using social media to manipulate perceptions, not just of Turkey outside of their borders, but perceptions within your borders of your own nation. A lot of countries know how effective this is. The United States is lagging behind both in defending against it and participating in it, because here in the U.S., we tend to think that perception campaigns, narrative campaigns, the suggestion that they work, we find insulting.
Right.
We think that you're calling us dumb by saying it, but marketing works. None of us argue whether or not marketing works. We invest trillions of dollars into marketing each year, maybe $1 trillion each year. Marketing and propaganda are the same thing, just with different paychecks paying for it. Marketing works, which means narrative campaigns work. We need to be aware of that. While we're arguing and yelling and screaming at each other, our goal should be making things better, finding common ground, progressing as a nation. Those are not the goals China, Russia, Iran are advancing on social media. The goals that foreign powers are advancing are that there is no common ground for us, and the only way forward is my way or the highway. For a lot of us, that comes naturally anyway. We're inclined to want to go to war. And America is so big that we don't see one another as part of the same tribe anymore. We've divided ourselves into tribes within the United States that are battling against one another. And a lot of these foreign powers that have far more unified forms of government because they're totalitarian, they don't have to contend with that. A lot of people are unhappy in Russia. That doesn't much matter to Vladimir Putin. A lot of people are unhappy in China. That doesn't much matter to Xi Jinping. China is going to tell us that we're wrong because there are race issues in our country. Well, they have a million Muslims in concentration camps. A lot of people aren't aware of how these countries actually operate, so they're just eager to get allies from wherever they can find them. And it concerns me when I start seeing domestic political groups championing messaging from outside of the United States from people who clearly have bad intentions. It's scary stuff to me.
Well, if I were to ask you, who destroys their history? I think if you were a current events person, you would say, recently? I think the Taliban did that. I think ISIS did it in the areas they occupied. If I asked you, who doesn't believe in freedom of speech for everybody, right? I mean, we would keep coming back on these questions. Who doesn't believe in due process? I mean, it keeps coming back to totalitarian regimes, and you're seeing more of that in terms of, you know, yeah, no, you don't have a right to say that because I disagree with it. Like, wait a minute, I thought there was a First Amendment. And this shit started, you know, years ago, and if you remember, you know, conservative speakers going to try to speak in Berkeley. Couldn't do it. People riot. Mm-hmm. People loot. People destroy shit. Well, those are, I mean, and I've talked about, you know, in our country now, you know, I would tell you that largely the truth doesn't matter. It's the narrative that matters. So,
I agree with that. Lord knows I agree with that.
Right. And so to me, yesterday I was talking and I kind of said, you know, the demise of journalism, you know, coincides with the rise of the internet. Now, Mac, how can you say that? Well, I'll tell you how. You could do journalism as an editor and publisher of a paper because you had the classified ads as revenue. You had subscriptions. Paper boys are flinging papers every day, right? You're selling them on the streets. And you had this revenue base that assured you financially. So relative to your journalistic approach, you had this base and you could be balanced. You could be more fair. That all went away. The classifieds went first, followed by the print subscriptions. And now the way you get people to look at what you do is you put up Liz Hurley bikini pictures or whatever else.
Or you appeal specifically to their confirmation bias or specifically to their outrage.
And I read a headline yesterday from Marine Corps Times, you know, and the headline was stabbed Marine dies, military spouse shot in Camp Lejeune incident, right? Well, in reading that, I think, wow, what happened where a Marine would be stabbed and died? And then somebody's wife is killed? Well, it wasn't. It was another Marine whose wife's a Marine. He was the military spouse, right? But the whole way they wrote that, right, doesn't say separated Marine, you know, still living on base, right? It's designed to be provocative to get you to click, so that you're part of the data, so revenue source of the data, blah, blah, blah. And it's the competitive nature of journalism now that fuels this narrative on each side that is not devoted to the truth as much.
You know, I agree. And I think that social media, it's not just the digital distribution that makes things faster and more competitive, but it's also the way social media is leveraged for reach.
Right.
It really – I mean, we've talked about this before, but the best way to get a lot of exposure for a story is to have it be extremely controversial, right? And I've certainly worked for outlets that used that model, you know, where if we can get people upset enough, then we'll get tons of traffic on this story. Or if we can – get the people that agree with us so in agreement with us that they share this to show everybody else how wrong they are. That's really the way social media reach works. So if you've got a great example of Sandbox News, which if you haven't visited us, we're an entirely apolitical, military-specific news outlet, right? So Sandbox News has a fairly small social media footprint at this point because we're a new outlet. We have, you know, 1,000-something followers on Facebook. I think I have around 30,000 on Twitter. The scope of people I can access through that very narrow lane is incredibly small, in large part because platforms like Facebook charge you money to reach the people who like your content. So if you have 1,000 fans, Facebook will only show it to 7 of them for free. And you have to pay them, you know, $50 to show it to 200 more and what have you. I can promise you right now that any company that does advertising on social media, any media distribution outlet that has a Facebook presence, one of their largest marketing expenses each month is Facebook. Every outlet I've ever worked for pays Facebook tens of thousands of dollars per month just for Facebook to show people the content that people ask for from Facebook. So it's the devil. right? So what do you do to try to beat that organic reach limitation, especially if you're budget-minded? Maybe you don't have $70,000 a month to pay Facebook just to show the people who asked for your content your content. So what's the other way to do it? The other way to increase your organic reach, to get more people to see your content on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, what have you, is to have people share it. Sharing it is the most successful way of getting more exposure. But if they comment on it, that ranks second. And if they click like or the care button or the heart or what have you on Facebook, on Twitter, it's just like, that's the third, right? So your organic reach is dictated by how many people have already liked your content, and then how many people share it, how many people comment on it, and how many people like it. So a lot of outlets leverage outrage specifically because they know that if you're really angry, whether it's at them for the way they present a story or it's at the story itself, you're much more apt to share it to say, look at what these crazy guys are doing. Look at what a terrible outlet this is. Look at how I'm right about Republicans or Democrats. Look at this. Look at this. People share things for one of two reasons usually, either because it shows how right they are or because they're showing how wrong you are. And when those are the two most powerful drivers for the most important form of social media engagement, it creates an inclination to write crazy, sensational crap. You know, a few years ago, I won't name the outlet, but I saw a headline that really summed this up well for me. It was a story called, like, U.S. Special Operations and U.K. Royal Marines storm cruise ship after ISIS takes it over, or something like that. And when I clicked on the article, it wasn't until the third paragraph that it pointed out that it was a training exercise and that the ISIS terrorists on the ship were role players. There was not a single passenger anywhere on the ship. It was not even a currently in use cruise ship. It was just a training rotation that some special operations guys got in the event something like that would ever happen. But most of the country doesn't click on the article, and most people who click don't read the third paragraph, right? So how many times do you think that article got shared by people going, oh my God, ISIS took over a cruise ship?
See, I told you, right?
Exactly. Right? How many times after people did realize it was bullshit do you think people shared it saying,
very rarely,
look at this story, it's bullshit?
Very rarely. Right now, you know? only the upside. Let me ask you. I'm curious. You live in the South. You live in Georgia, right? You're a veteran. What have you seen relative to all this stuff domestically that you find most disturbing?
Well, I think I have a little bit of an optimistic slant on this, but the thing that I find the most disturbing is that I tend not to watch television news because I don't have cable. You know, we've been a cable cutter for many years. I'm a Netflix and Hulu guy, you know, but I've been watching more TV news on YouTube lately. And I live, like I said, about 30 minutes outside of Atlanta. I live in one of those McMansion HOAs where everybody is pretty nice to everybody. There are a lot of different ethnicities in this environment, but everybody's kind of middle class working guys. You know, my next door neighbor owns a landscaping company. I would argue that I'm probably in, even though ethnically it's fairly diverse, I'm in a pretty sheltered little bubble, you know. But when you watch the news, it really does look like America is a war zone. And I understand that in some places America genuinely is. And all the driving around that I've done in these Atlanta suburbs and all the interacting that I've done with my neighbors and other people in town, I haven't seen any repercussions of this turmoil in person. I've seen lots of it on the news. I've seen tons of it on the internet. But even this close to Atlanta, where there's been plenty of issues, I haven't seen any protests. I have seen some people holding signs or putting up signs in front of their houses or in front of their businesses, which totally cool. I've interacted with my neighbors and it hasn't come up in conversation really, other than just, you know, we're not going to take our kids into Atlanta or something like that. So I think that it's worth noting that America, by and large, is not on fire and is not tearing itself apart. But if your idea of America is based on media exposure, then you're going to be utterly certain that these are the end days. I really do feel like we may be living in the fall of Rome, and that's possible, honestly. I feel like it is entirely possible. But at the same time, when I go outside and my neighbor has got his kids, because the landscaping business has been kind of slow as of late because of the coronavirus, obviously. So he's been doing a lot of work to his own yard, and it looks beautiful. But he's got his three kids out there, you know, shoveling dirt out of the back of his pickup truck and planting stuff and watering stuff. When I go and talk to my neighbors, we go, yeah, things are pretty crazy, but I'm glad they're good around here. When I go to the store, people go, yeah, things are pretty crazy, but I'm glad they're good around here. I haven't seen all the bad that the news would have you believe is everywhere. I do think there's a lot of bad going on around the country. It's impossible to ignore that there's lots of bad going on around the country. But I think the most disturbing part of this is that because we're all, especially in many places, still isolating at home, Georgia is not, but a lot of places there are, even in places where lockdowns have been lifted, people are still choosing to stay home because they're nervous or they're worried. So more than ever, our idea of what this country is being dictated through our social lenses. And our social lenses are echo chambers of bullshit. You know, my wife has probably a further left-leaning social circle that she runs in on social media than I do. On Facebook in particular, I have really, really liberal and really, really conservative people just by the nature of the fact that I'm a guy from Vermont who also spent a long time in the Marines, you know?
Yeah, there you go. There you go. The left and the right.
Yeah, and it's troubling to me how different this country looks right now depending on which lens you're seeing it through. If you're seeing it through a digital lens that is informed by your peer group, your friend circle, the outlets that you choose to follow, the version of America that you're seeing right now is very different than the same country among people with a different friend group, with a different peer circle, with different outlets that they choose to follow. If you are a conservative guy that watches Fox News, reads Breitbart every day, and you're not friends with Democrats on Facebook, the world that you see is in a stark contrast to if you're a liberal person who doesn't like Republicans, only gets your news from CNN. The world that you're seeing is entirely different too. And it's scary to me that right now, when so many people are only seeing the world beyond the horizon from their digital windows, their computers, their phones, it makes this – and I don't know. I think that it's not improving anything. It is making people afraid of one another. It's making people afraid of causes. And in my experience,
what's interesting, Alex,
real people aren't that bad.
All right. And here's what I think, if I could look over the horizon. At some point, this will dissipate, right? And at that point, the adults that are supposed to be in the room right now and stand up and say, all right, everybody get in their seats. This is how this is going to go. And they belong to both sides. Hey, this is how we're going to, you know, resolve. This is how we're going to look at these things. You know, at some point, they'll come back in the room because right now they're afraid. Right.
I agree.
They're hiding. It's in my opinion, it's pathetic. But anyway,
I really think you can't, like, pragmatism right now is seen as a weakness.
Yeah. No. So at some point, right, we will have a rational discussion about the truth and we'll fight about that. And then I think people will see the strength of our country, that a lot of countries could not go through this and come out on the other side and be better. The United States will. And we'll take a look. Ultimately, we will debate our history. Is it important? I mean, is our history ours to like or not like? Or is it simply ours? I mean, that's a huge discussion. So instead of bleaching our history, is there a better way to tell the more complete story of our history?
And I would like to ask the rhetorical question. Can you name – I'm not asking you this, but can anyone name – a modern developed civilization that isn't built, unfortunately, on the graves of the civilizations that came before it. I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm saying
it's just human nature, right?
It's just history.
It's the truth of history. And let me tell you, to hold, you know, so for instance, George Washington lives and dies when slavery in the world is legal. He releases his slaves upon the death of his wife, and that's in his will, I believe. And so he was an atypical leader of this country. But now we're going to say, well, we don't believe in that. He was wrong. Well, if we woke him up and said, hey, George, do you know that we all think you're a piece of shit because you own slaves? And he'd say, wait a minute. I mean, that's the world I grew up in. That's how it was. I mean, you're telling me that, you know, what's next? That owning dogs is going to be at some point in the next 100 years going to be deemed as, you know, oh, he was a dog owner. What?
Well, honestly, man, I think that this speaks to like what a threat that we're all facing genuinely.
So how do we embrace? So my question is, how do we embrace our less than perfect history? Martin Luther King's, you know, cheated on his wife. So at what point do we not accept our flawed history with footnotes and then tell the whole story? For instance, and this is something I don't know where Stone Mountain is relative to you, but in Georgia, rather than dynamiting the figures off that have been carved into Stone Mountain off, why don't we commission a second mural? Why don't we commission a side-by-side mural that has Martin Luther King, Ralph Abernathy, Malcolm X, and whoever else you want to put on that thing? And then tell the whole story about this was this during a time of Reconstruction, funded by this, tried to represent this. This is the other part of this story, and this is our history, whether we like it or fucking not.
I think that our history is suffering from the same problem. I wrote an article a long time ago called "The Era of Heroes is Over," because at this point in our society, we are unwilling to allow anyone to have flaws, unwilling to allow any form of flaw to exist. Right. And it makes me really nervous for especially the next generation. I hope the next generation is the one that learns how to forgive people for their mistakes.
Well, do you think that that's where this will ultimately head up? That one of the things that's going to come out of this is, okay, it's clear our media has been hijacked and everybody's listening in mono, right? We need to listen in surround sound, okay? And everybody's got to get that memo. Dissent is important. Protection of minority rights is important, and the tyranny of the majority is never a good idea. And so do you think that we're going to relearn these lessons just like I think we talked about a month ago? We learned the importance of a savings account. It was such an old-fashioned idea, and come on, Grandma, really? Oh, shit, no paychecks for, you know, 2.5 months? Maybe I should have had those 90 days, right?
I hope we are going to learn. I hope that – in all honesty, professionally I tend to maintain an optimistic outlook. Personally, I maintain a pretty pessimistic one. I have for a long time gone, our systems are too bureaucratic to pivot.
The dichotomy.
You know, a good example being a buddy of mine works in aviation. And the same week that Donald Trump, you know, went on TV and said, hey, we should probably take this thing really seriously. We're going to shut everything down. Let's, you know, do a couple of weeks of this and see what the solution is or what have you. His plant shut down because they were told to by state officials. And then 3 days later, the FAA sent a group of auditors from Texas, flew them to the plant, made them restaff and reopen the plant to stand an audit that was mandated by the same government that told them to close the plant down. Because our system is so bloated with bureaucracy that we are incapable of pivoting quickly enough to go, hey, maybe we shouldn't do a surprise audit while we told the plants to shut down. I got pulled over, and fortunately for me, the cop was a great guy. He was very nice about it. But my registration was close to lapsing, close to expiring. And he was like, you know, you need to – I just wanted to let you know your registration is going to expire. And I was like, the DMV's closed, man. What do you want me to do? And he was like, You know, that's a great point. Just stay on top of it. You know, make sure you get in there to renew it as soon as you can.
Dude, you're getting A.
You know, if we're not able to go, hey, maybe we should take it easy on giving tickets for registrations being lapsed when the DMV is closed. If we're not able to go, hey, maybe we should not spend $10,000 flying a team of auditors for a surprise inspection on a plant we made them close. If we're not able to do that stuff, I worry that we're not going to be able to make bigger, more dramatic changes and anything even remotely to a reasonable amount of time, especially because we as a country can't decide on what the important things are. You know, we all want to fight about the bike rack. Nobody wants to talk about the nuclear plant. That's what we're doing on social media every day. God's honest truth, it's what the media is doing in large part too. You know, and
well, that's my point. I think that on the far side of this, and it's not going to be anytime soon, I would tell
I hope
you.
You're right, man.
On the far side of this, we're going to look and we're going to say, what are the elements that contributed to a discussion when we look at databases maintained by the FBI and the Washington Post that say police killings of unarmed black men are coming down every year and are now, 40% of what they were in 2015, and yet the nation was convinced that there was a black genocide going on, and we had prominent politicians around the country saying that kind of stuff. What were the elements that contributed to that? So I'm more optimistic.
I hope that you're right, man. I love that.
It's always been the strength of the nation that at some point we get to a tipping point and the great middle class and the great silent majority rise up and say, yeah, enough of that. We have historically throughout our history. So I keep my fingers crossed. Tell me what you're writing about this week, and tell everybody where they can find all the great work that you guys are doing.
Got it. Well, definitely check out sandboxnews.com. That's Sandbox with two X's. We launched an entirely new site layout last week, which was a long time coming. I still have lots of sleep to catch up on from the changeover, but it looks great. It's way more functional. You can find lots more content on the page now. We've got some really cool stuff coming out. I have my first edition of a series about what we can be doing within the military apparatus, both as a media entity and as members of the military community, to make sure that this country's prepared for the next generation of threats. The first edition of this series is an interview I did with Ward Carroll, who, for anybody who's not familiar with him, he was an F-14 weapons guy for a long time. Then he became public affairs for the MV-22 Osprey program for a long time. And then he went in and took over military.com when it was just after the dot-com bubble, when it was a really struggling outlet. He has since either written for or ran a number of very prominent institutions like the Naval Institute. Awesome guy, a military media OG. And he's got a lot of really important things to impart about what the media can do better and what the audience can do better for the military apparatus. So that first issue will probably be out sometime this week, maybe on Friday, depending on how crazy things get. But we've got tons of other great content going up every day. We're publishing like 8 stories a day from veterans, some active duty guys like F-35 pilots, military spouses. Please check out sandboxnews.com. You can find lots of my stuff on Facebook at facebook.com/AlexHollingsWriter, or you can find me on Twitter at AlexHollings52, or Sandbox at Twitter, which is just at Sandbox with two X's.
There you have it, Alex Hollings. First of all, happy Father's Day, and always enjoy the visit, and keep doing – for those of you who don't know, when Alex kind of recites the numbers of Sandbox – news and followers, and you know, whether it be Twitter or Facebook, when he started, those things were like not very much. And
it's I'm getting there. We're getting there.
No, I mean, so the progress that you've made over just a few months is substantial. So congratulations on that. And as always, thanks for the visit.
Thanks, brother. I'll talk to you soon.
There you have it. Alex Hollings. More of Allman Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.